Good morning. Please be seated. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nancy Collins here on behalf of Bruce Hall. If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Oh, I can tell. All right.
Sorry. Despite its efforts, the prosecution found no evidence showing how or where Ms. Hummel died. But they chose to ask the jury to consider only premeditated murder in Bruce Hummel's trial and took on the burden as well of proving that the acts constituting premeditated murder all occurred in Washington.
As you know, we directed the parties to address the recent U.S. Supreme Court case in addition to the question of what evidence there is as to premeditation, which I think, frankly, is more the state than you. But the recent U.S. Supreme Court case, I think you need to address in the context of your argument concerning the jury instruction and the burden to prove acts.
Yes, yes, and I'll move straight to that. You know, in Hickman, our Supreme Court said the law of the case doctrine is an established doctrine with roots reaching back to the earliest days of statehood. Now, Musascio decides in the Fifth Amendment context that the prosecution does not need to prove elements that the court adds into a jury instruction that weren't part of the indictment. But Musascio is different for several reasons that don't control this case. First, Musascio expressly reserves for appellate courts and certainly state courts to create their own doctrines that confine review by courts. Page 716 in the Supreme Court Reporter, they say, you know, we're not addressing issues such as waiver, forfeiture, estoppel, and other challenges. And here, unlike Musascio, which is a case where the court crafted that instruction on its own and simply the prosecution didn't object, here we have an instruction proposed by the prosecution, which would fall within and the sort of the waiver or forfeiture, and they took on that obligation. In addition, Hickman says, the state in Hickman said, you know, we ask you to abandon this doctrine. It's not required by due process. And our Supreme Court said, refused to do so. They said we see benefits in this. It encourages objections. It's consistent with Criminal Court Rule 615, which requires proposed written instructions in advance. And the state acquiesced, and we're not going to abandon this doctrine. And this court is frankly bound by Hickman. Hickman says that.
Well, no, we're not. Not on the question of what the test is for 14th Amendment due process proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
The
U.S. Supreme Court is the Stranger Creek doctrine for the state Supreme Court itself wouldn't apply. If it's wrong, it wouldn't have to be harmful.
Hickman is a doctrine that is not bound by the Fifth Amendment. It's not. It's always been the case. And although there was a circuit split,
the Supreme Court decided State versus Green, and then the U.S. Supreme Court decided Jackson versus Virginia, and then the state Supreme Court re-decided State versus Green, and adopted, acquiesced, gave heed to, whatever phrase we want to use, the notion that 14th Amendment proof beyond a reasonable doubt and the Jackson versus Virginia standard were the standards that applied in Washington. And it's never wavered from that. And then this case says that whatever it is that would arise from a to convict instruction that adds elements, it's not 14th Amendment proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and it's not subject to the Jackson test. So does the state have to prove it by preponderance? Do the state have to prove it at all?
Well,
under the Fifth Amendment, the government doesn't have to prove it at all.
Yes. I mean, that's true. Musascio says that clearly. And that's really been the case in most circuits, too, in the federal courts. They didn't have this law of the case doctrine the way we have in Washington that we have long enforced.
And the U.S. Supreme Court makes clear that it's not the law of the case doctrine.
Yes. And under the Fifth Amendment, it is not. And that is clear from Musascio, which is
Fifth Amendment because it's a federal prosecution. But there's no difference between the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment due process clauses for court.
And I'm not trying to draw that distinction as well. But my point is twofold. First, Musashi was distinguishable because it was a situation where the court added an element that wasn't even in the indictment in their instruction. It wasn't something the prosecution had ever asked to take on that burden of proving. And Musashi explicitly reserved saying we're not addressing those other scenarios and other doctrines such as waiver, forfeiture, estoppel, or other types of challenges that might constrain the appellate court review. And separately, the second point we make is that Hickman is a doctrine that, you know, we do have common law doctrines. We are allowed to create more restrictive standards, and Hickman is evidence of that. Hickman says, because this is a long-standing common law doctrine that we're not deviating from, and because of that, it's a separate element that is required under our state law and our state common law that distinguishes Musashio and makes Hickman until
the first State versus Green case applied Washington's then existing substantial evidence test. Didn't have to meet the Jackson standard. It was a lesser standard, mm-hmm. and it was equivalent of the what in some federal circuits was called the no evidence test, or the converse, the any evidence test. So is that the standard that we would apply, the standard applied in the first State versus Green decision, the one that predated Jackson?
Hickman says that the state's bound to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, I know that Hickman talks about the common law doctrine as well as they do blend it. They talk about the state roots of this doctrine, and then they also discuss sort of the due process constitutional requirements. But you think you can take from that very clear language in Hickman that this is an established doctrine with roots tracing back from statehood. The parties are bound by the instructions. We have a criminal court rule that requires those instructions. The jury was instructed that those are the elements that must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's the face of that instruction that's proposed that sets the standard of what the state must prove, and sort of the evidentiary standard of beyond a reasonable doubt is set out in that instruction and would also control, and you know, in this case. My time is short. I can reserve or answer more questions right now.
Thank you.
Good morning, Kimberly Talene, on behalf of Whatcom County, on behalf of the state of Washington. Before I address the issue of the sufficiency of the premeditation, I just would like to respond briefly and point out to the court that this was an all-or-nothing strategy that was chosen by Mr. Hummel. If you look at the report of proceedings from 557 to 562, the state proposed murder two instructions, but the defendant did not want that. He wanted to go to trial and to litigate the issue of premeditation for the jury.
Well, if the state proposed murder two.
State did propose. Didn't have any objection to it being withdrawn, but it was,
well,
Mr. Hummel.
Okay,
it wasn't.
Didn't have any objection to it being withdrawn is not the same as, yeah, you proposed, but you didn't then ask the court, not you, but the prosecutors,
correct.
Did not then ask the court after it was withdrawn to give it on behalf of the state. So now let's turn to,
correct,
because the record will show whatever the record shows, but let's turn to premeditation, because the question is, what is the evidence of premeditation? We know what the prosecutor argued below, and
correct,
I think on appeal, consistent with that argument, the state is arguing, well, there was motive, and then there was this plan to conceal.
Well, you know, here's the issue. Whether or not the circumstantial evidence in this case supports the element of premeditation.
Right.
And premeditation may be inferred from conduct that is plainly indicated as a matter of logical probability, even in a no-body homicide case like this. And when you look at the facts where the reasonable inferences from the facts demonstrate motive, opportunity, we had a timing of between the disclosure of SK disclosing the ongoing molestation by Mr. Hummel. She discloses that within 3 to 5 days of that disclosure, and mom saying she would take care of it, as even Mr. Hummel.
No question there's motive. So
there's motive.
So what else
there
is
was
there?
And there was timing, and there's method, that the killing was done away from the home. There was absolutely no forensic.
How do we know it was away from the home?
because the forensic evidence in terms of showing any blood evidence and the ability forensically for Mr. Hummel to be able to biomechanically move.
But the biomechanic expert testified that he didn't consider whether Mr. Hummel could have wrapped her body in plastic and dragged it out.
Well, there was absolutely no evidence from the children that there had been any disturbance within the home. They were there. They were living there day to day. They were going to school, coming home at 3:30.
Well, they weren't there during this short period of time.
And I think the biomechanical expert testimony suggested that it was highly unlikely that he would have been able to do that.
The evidence seems to be that, or the argument seems to be that, the absolute absence of evidence that she was killed in the home establishes the premeditation element in a murder in which you allege she was killed in the home.
In which we allege that she was killed in the home?
Yeah. Isn't that your contention, that she was killed in the home?
No, the allegation was not that she was killed in the home. The theory below was that, in fact, that he likely lured her out of the home. She never left the home. She rarely left the home. She was a very heavy woman, about 270.
So then what's the significance? What's the significance of that?
Well, the significance is, because she rarely left the home, that fact... and the fact that she was heavy, and because of her medical issues, that it was likely that somehow he was able to get her out of the home, and that the death was done in a way that concealed the death to enable him to continue with the sophisticated plan. It's not suggestive of a spontaneous act. When you have those facts that infer reasonably the fact that the killing was away from the home and done in a manner to conceal the death and the killing, combined with the ample motive, which, as Justice Schindler has pointed out, there is ample motive in this case to avoid the repercussions of molestation, to be able to continue his life without it. Basically, you know, whether he went to prison or not, his life was not going to be the same. Mom was going to take care of the molestation.
Is there any case that you think is similar to this case?
I think the People versus Scott, which was a California case, or Scott versus Cal, I can't recall. I think it's cited within the State versus Nesland site, is similar, but I'm not sure. I'd have to go look. But no, I mean, this is a unique case. We do have no body homicide cases.
Typically with no body homicide cases, there's some evidence of planning beforehand, or indication and evidence related to something that happened beforehand that allows for a reasonable inference. So here, what do you have beforehand? You have motive.
We have the disclosure of the molestation. We have the mom.
The motive.
It does go to motive, but it also goes to the timing. It's hand in hand with the timing of the sudden disappearance. This was not a.
So you have motive, and you have the sudden disappearance.
And you have the.
What else do you have?
And you have the lack of any evidence in the home of the confrontation occurring there, or some spontaneous act that resulted in her death. There is no body. There's concealment. There was an effort by Mr. Hummel, I think, even that day he came home.
I mean, couldn't you say the concealment is after the murder?
Not if it's done in a manner to ensure that the death did not occur in the home, when you have someone who would not leave the home. She was not physically well enough to leave the home. She wouldn't even go out for grocery shopping or to garden. This was not someone who left the home. But it was someone.
That would be equally true if he just spontaneously whacked her over the head with something when she confronted him.
Correct.
You know, he's still going to cover it up, so it's not probative that he had premeditation.
Well, his motive is probative, and when you combine it, like Bingham, State versus Bingham talks about the fact that just the strangulation alone was not, you know, the opportunity, if you will, was not enough to support the premeditation. But the court went on, I believe, in the language in Bingham to talk about that had there been a history, had there been motive, that in conjunction with that method would be sufficient. And I think really, you know,
but
we're
here,
trying
what's
to piece
our,
it apart.
What's our method here?
Concealment. I mean, the method is we've got a clever killer who killed her in a manner that no one detected that she had died.
But that's
it wasn't until he was confronted years later that he admitted that she had died and then gave different various ways that she had died and everything else, none of which the evidence supported forensically. I mean, we went back, we checked.
But that's consistent with accidental death and panicking and wanting to cover it up. That's consistent with spontaneous rage and trauma and then wanting to cover it up. You know, that's all about consequences.
Well, I think that, again, we have to step back, and this evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the state. What is the reasonable inference from the fact that she did not leave the home, that she was going to take care of the molestation, that within the 3 to 5 days of that occurring, that she suddenly disappears? It is, and that there was then, as reflected in Hummel's behavior after the fact, that there was a more sophisticated plan at play, a strategy, if you will, and that he put into action. It's not suggestive. The kids were in the van. It's not suggestive that there was a whacking that occurred in the van or or blood in the van. There was that.
Well, they didn't find the van. I mean, they did go and look for the van.
But no, they had the van at the time. The kids, of course, because of the constant emotional and manipulative abuse by Mr. Hummel, did not question. I mean, they were told their mother had abandoned them, and that was they had a bad mother. And so the van was there. The kids did not testify that they saw anything of concern. That is suggestive, not of a spontaneous act. It's suggestive of someone who engaged in planning activity. You had motive, opportunity, timing, method, which was concealment. And while, in some ways, that is more suggestive of premeditation than someone who is strangled in the Bingham case. And so, yes, what this court has to look back at, just like this, is we're looking at, the essential elements of the crime. And two juries, not just one, found Mr. Hummel.
In the first jury, there was different testimony. You had the jailhouse informant in the first trial.
We did. But regardless, both.
And he testified about how she was murdered.
That Mr. Hummel had made some statements. Correct. But in this case, you've got Mr. Hummel, who's made several different statements. We've got the testimony of the children that she had medication.
They weren't of the same nature as the statements that were testified to in the first trial.
Not with respect to the informant. But my point is that the jury was instructed as to what was required to make that finding. The jury found it at the halftime motion. The trial court found it, and the trial court being in the best position to evaluate the credibility of the testimony by the Hummel children and others. And so I would ask this court to find that Mr. Hummel is guilty of murder in the first degree with premeditation. Thank you.
I just want to quickly note with the nature of the record and the state's proposed instructions, the state's instructions were not filed officially, so I wasn't able to track down an official copy of those proposed instructions. But on page 550, the court says, I'm going to start with the state's instructions and go through them one by one. There was only a premeditated murder. It was a single instruction that they proposed with a single verdict form, and the state and the court says if there are going to be lessers, we'll use different verdict forms. We only have one here, which indicates that the state only proposed that single premeditated murder instruction, identically to what they did at the first trial. You can see the proposed instructions at the first trial, the state's proposed, are the same as what the court gave here.
But in the first trial, didn't the court instruct on murder in the second
degree? Yes, and it was
that
the defense
request. Was that at the request of the defense?
Yes.
But here, the state could have requested.
They could have requested it, and they opted not to.
Even after the defense withdrew?
Yes, even after the defense withdrew. They showed no indication of any interest in seeking that, any type of lessers whatsoever, and were free to, and there was a discussion about it, and they never asked to seek that. And then moving on to the basic premeditation issue, is that there really is every other case you see has some information about a weapon being obtained, procured, used, a number of injuries, how injuries were inflicted, planning at least in terms of changing a will or getting a life insurance policy or making some.
So planning beforehand.
Prior actions indicating that the period of deliberation, that reflection, and the premeditated intent, which is required for the most serious offense. The state's argument is essentially because there is no evidence, we take that to mean the most serious crime has been committed because he covered it up so well. And that's simply not our standard of permissible, reasonable inferences that have to be based on logical proof and can't be purely speculative. And that's simply what we have here, despite efforts the police made to try to define some forensic link or some plausible explanation. We are left at the end of the day with no information about how or where she died, and therefore there's insufficient evidence of premeditation. And because of this all-or-nothing strategy, Hidari says that reversal and dismissal is required. The jury wasn't asked to consider a lesser offense, and therefore there is no lesser available for this court to consider under our court rules. So we ask you to dismiss the conviction and reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. The next case is Rickman and Primera.